So, how can we talk about Jesus without looking like an idiot? I'm sure we can all identify to this with this to some degree. And Andy has written a book on this with this exact title, and he's going to be giving us the pearls from that book today. So the question is how we can have natural conversations with our friends and family about our faith. This webinar is going to explore why we don't need to be afraid or uncomfortable, the four questions that help people open up, the five steps to responding to tough questions, and how effortlessly to bring faith into a conversation. That's often the hardest part, isn't it? How to introduce it first of all. But it doesn't need to be awkward, and everyday conversations that open the door to evangelism can be painless and natural, even though they're part of a spiritual battle. Dr. Andy Bannister is the director of SOLAS, which is an evangelism and training organization based in Scotland in the UK, but covering the whole of the UK. And he's broadcasting today from the south of England. A highly in-demand speaker, Andy speaks and teaches throughout the UK, but also Europe, Canada, the USA, and the wider world. I'm not sure if he's spoken quite to 50 countries simultaneously like today, but he's saying no. So from universities to churches, business forums to TV and radio, he regularly addresses audience of both Christians and those of all faiths and none on issues relating to faith, culture, politics, and society. And we were just chatting beforehand, and Andy was in my hometown of St. Albans, speaking at a local golf club to a group of largely non-Christians just a week or so ago. Andy's got a PhD in Islamic studies, and he's taught extensively at universities across Canada, the USA, the UK, and further afield on both Islam and philosophy. He's also an adjunct research fellow at the Arthur Jeffrey Centre for the Study of Islam at Melbourne School of Theology in Australia, and is also adjunct faculty at Wycliffe College in the University of Toronto. So a truly international background, Andy, and it's just such a pleasure to have you today speaking. And I know there's a lot of people here really wanting to hear what you have to say and how you can make evangelism easier for us, brother. So over to you. Thank you.
Well, bless you, Peter. Thank you for that introduction, and hello to all of you. And I'll just switch to my my slide deck as we dive in. Real privilege to be with you this afternoon, and to address such an international audience. I've got a bit of an international background, myself, having lived in two countries, three, if you count Scotland, and married to a Swede. So we move in international circles, but never 50 countries at the same time, Peter. So thank you for that. Well, as you heard, I work for an organization called SOLAS, which we focus on two things. Firstly, taking the message of Jesus outside of the four walls of the church. And then secondly, we help equip Christians, particularly equip them to share their faith in the workplace or the university, wherever they spend their kind of Monday through Saturday lives. But although I'm currently, right now, in full-time Christian ministry, I wasn't always in Christian ministry. In fact, it feels very appropriate to be speaking to such an esteemed medical audience because my first job was actually working for the health service here in the UK. I worked for the NHS. I worked for a place called St. George's Hospital Medical School down in South London. Actually, the hospital I was born in, strangely enough, but I worked for them then for 6 or 7 years, helping them organize and run medical conferences and ongoing training for doctors and so on. And I loved my years working there in the health service. Loved my time in the 1990s working at St. George's. But I feel, looking back, some not inconsiderable guilt that during my time at a St. George's hospital, I was very much an undercover Christian. In fact, I've long thought that undercover Christian would make quite a good title for a movie, quite frankly, about Christians sort of, sneaking around at work, hoping nobody would actually realize they were, in fact, Christians. So what do I mean by undercover Christian? Well, what I mean was this, that although outside of work, I was a very active Christian, very involved in my local church, especially in youth ministry and other activities inside work, inside the hospital, I would take my little light of faith. I took my little candle of faith and I put that light of faith under a bowl, and I put the bowl inside a box, and I surrounded the box by blackout curtains. Nobody was going to find out I was a Christian. I hid my faith away and I didn't talk about it. And by the way, I wasn't alone in this. I actually remember the week that I left St. George's after working there for 6 years, they threw me a little leaving lunch. And I discovered at this leaving lunch that a colleague who I had worked with for 5 or 6 years on the same corridor as me, well, she was also a Christian, and she too had been playing undercover Christian for 6 years, and we hadn't discovered one another. So, looking back on that experience from the benefit of 25 years on, what was it that I was afraid of? What kept me from talking about my faith more publicly at work, being more open with my colleagues and those I engaged with? Well, I think if you'd asked the 25-year-old me why I kept my faith hidden away, I would have said things like this to you. I would have said, well, what if I talk about my faith in Jesus and I look like an idiot? I look stupid. That is a fear that holds many of us back, and it certainly held me back. I was afraid I would just look stupid. Perhaps more spiritually, I might have said, well, I'm afraid of making God look bad. You know, what if I talk about the gospel and I do such a bad job? Quite frankly, it would have been better to have said nothing in the first place. That was a real fear. I think I'd have said, I'm afraid of standing out from the crowd. You know, workplaces can be very conformist environments where there's a pressure to look the same. And I certainly felt that. And I realized that being a Christian would look different. And I was afraid. I think I'd have said, what about the implications for my career? You know, lots of Christians, I think, have this fear that if we talk about our faith at work, maybe it affects our career prospects. And that was certainly a fear that affected me. And then I think I'd have said to you, but what if I'm asked a question I can't answer? You know, what if I identify as a Christian at work and my colleagues say, okay, you're a Christian. What about science? What about sexuality? What about suffering? What about 1,001 other topics? And I realized I had no answers, or thought I did, and so I said nothing. Well, over the years, I have come to realize I was not alone in those fears. The fear of talking about your faith at work or at university with unbelieving friends or family is very common. And I suspect many of you on this webinar have fears that you might add to that list, hence why you've signed up for this webinar. So many men and women I talk to tell me, Andy, I'd love to be more confident in talking about my faith, but I'm just afraid. And so I too say nothing at work. So how do we overcome this? How do we overcome these fears that hold many of us back from talking about Jesus in our workplaces, among our friends, and so on? Well, I first got an insight into this actually back in 2010. There was a real change for me, a real light bulb moment. We moved, that was the year we moved to Canada. I lived for 6 years in Toronto, in Canada, and before moving here to the UK. That is Toronto, by the way, not Swindon, where I currently live. And we moved to Toronto in Canada. And shortly after arriving in Canada, I became friends with a family doctor. Peter was his name. He attended our church. And I remember him saying something to me very early on in our friendship. He said to me, Andy, I love being a Christian and being a doctor because there are so many amazing opportunities for evangelism. And he went on to share how he had prayed with patients, talked about his faith with patients, had even had the opportunity of leading some patients to Christ right there in his surgery. Now, this, my ears pricked up, because Canada, like the UK where I live now and many other countries, it's quite tough, actually, being a Christian public service professional like a doctor. You know, there's real pressures not to bring your faith into the workplace. In fact, there have been stories recently here in the UK of Christian medics, you know, being threatened with disciplinary action merely for offering to pray with a patient. And Canada is equally as secular. So when Peter told me this, I remember saying to him, what are you doing? How are you doing all this and you haven't got yourself fired? Well, when I asked that question, Peter smiled, looked at me, and he said, Andy, it's really simple. When I have a patient in my surgery who is there for, you know, whatever reason, he said, I will do a little kind of life review with them. I will ask my patient, tell me about your diet. Are you exercising properly? I'll ask about sleep. Tell me about sleep. Are you sleeping well? Tell me about exercise. Are you exercising properly? And then Peter said the last question he will always ask is, tell me about spirituality. Are you making place for that in your life? And he said, you know, usually what happens is the patient will say, spirituality, what do you mean, doctor? And Peter will reply, well, you know, some people meditate, some people do yoga. I'm a Christian, though. I read the Bible. I pray. I go to church. Those kind of things. And he said, do you know, Andy, in a vast number of cases, what then happens is the patient asks the follow-up question. You pray, doctor. You know, what's all that about? Or you go to church. Why would you do that? They ask him a question. And because it's the patient asking him the question, he is infinitely freer to answer and continue the conversation because it's being led by the patient. And Pete's now been doing that for 30 years, something like 30 years now, I think, and has seen thousands of conversations with patients. He's prayed with patients. He's seen folks come to faith. All kinds of things have happened, and not a single complaint has happened in all of that time because of that approach that he's taken. And at the heart of Peter's approach, what he was doing, and the kind of light bulb moment for me was realizing he had discovered the power of questions. And basically, what I want to share with you in this webinar is that questions, I think, are one of the most powerful evangelistic tools we have. Yet, actually, they're one of the most overlooked evangelistic tools that we have. And look, the idea of using questions at the heart of our evangelism, whether at work or with our friends, is not some amazingly new idea, but the idea of using questions comes from Jesus himself, who was the master question asker. In fact, somebody has calculated that if you go through the Gospels and you count, Jesus asks something like 300 questions in the Gospels. So let's take an example. Let's look at how Jesus does it. And I'm going to teach you three questions that you yourself can learn to use. And you can use the questions I'll teach you again and again and again to help you start or to stay in conversations at work or with your friends, wherever you are. But let's start with the master himself. Let's start with Jesus. Now let's take a little look at this episode in Mark's gospel. In Mark chapter 10, we read that as Jesus started on his way, a man ran up to him and fell on his knees before him. Good teacher, he asked, what must I do to inherit eternal life? Why do you call me good? Jesus replied. No one is good except God alone. Now, I wonder when you've heard that story before, because I'm sure this is not the first time you've heard it. You found yourself thinking, what a fascinating response. I mean, it's a very strange response if you think about it. And the fact the sign is a strange response is you or I wouldn't use this approach, would we? Imagine that later on today, you're sitting at home on the couch, you know, relaxing this evening, minding your own business when there's a knock at the door and you hop up, you come to the door, you open the door and it's your next door neighbor. And your next door neighbor says to you, good Christian, what must I do to inherit eternal life? I'm pretty convinced none of us on this call would say what Jesus says here. Probably we'd say, come on in, the kettle's on. Let me answer that question for you. Maybe if you're a real coward, you might say, I've got a book I can give you. Let me give you a book or a leaflet or something. But why does Jesus not take a more straightforward approach? Why doesn't Jesus say, I'm the Son of God, follow me? Why doesn't Jesus say, you know, come along to, you know, the next time I'm preaching the Sermon on the Mount and I'll answer that question for you? Why does Jesus use this strange little question? Well, maybe there is something going on in this young man's life that Jesus needed to deal with. And then the way to deal with it was to ask a question. You see, think about this for a moment. If you were to get hold of a typical non-Christian, think of perhaps a non-Christian friend you have or a colleague or a neighbor, and you would say to your friend, look, I know you don't believe in God, but I want you to imagine for a moment. Just imagine that there was a God and that there was a heaven. What do you think you would need to do to get there? Well, having tried that thought experiment, the most common answer you get from people is be a good person. Most people think, most of our friends think, that if there was a God and if there was a heaven, then live a good life, be a nice person, and then God, if he exists, will let you into the afterlife. That's the most common response you hear in today's world. And this is what the young man is saying to Jesus. This young guy is saying to Jesus, well, you look like a good person. You're a famous rabbi with an amazing teaching and everyone's hanging off your every word. You are clearly a good person, Jesus. So tell me how I get to heaven. That's the mess that Jesus has to untangle. And he could have done it with a parable or a sermon or anything like that, but he doesn't. He does it with a question. Because when Jesus turns to the young man and says, why do you call me good? Only God is good. He's basically saying to the young man, you're absolutely right. All good people do go to heaven. But here's the thing. Who is good? And the answer is only God. So I'm afraid, actually, the only person who's going to heaven on that basis is God himself. And it also raises another interesting little question, doesn't it? If the young man has seen that Jesus is good, but only God is good, who exactly does that make Jesus in this conversation? Which becomes quite important, actually, because as you read on into the next section of their conversation, Jesus says to the young man, sell everything and follow me. And that demand only makes sense if the young man is confronted here by somebody far more than just your average Jewish rabbi. And Jesus did all of that he does by asking a question. Questions are incredibly powerful. And so in my kind of last 15 or 16 minutes or so of my time, I would like to share with you three powerful questions that you can learn to use in conversation after conversation. They're a bit like a sort of evangelistic toolkit that you can carry with you. The first two are really helpful for staying in a conversation that may have started. And the last one is helpful for starting faith-based conversations. So the three questions are simply this. Number one, what do you mean by that? Number two, why do you think that? And number three, have you ever wondered? Let me show you how they work with an example in each case, and then we'll draw the threads together. So let's take the first question on my list. What do you mean by that? Imagine this scenario. Let's imagine that you're sitting in a coffee shop somewhere in your town, and you're sitting in a coffee shop and you're minding your own business in the coffee shop when an old friend walks up. Noticing the big black leather Bible you're reading, because of course every Christian sitting in coffee shops carries the biggest Bible we can get our hands on, right? Noticing the Bible you're reading, your friend pipes up and they say, oh, you're not still into that religious rubbish, are you? Nobody believes in God these days. Belief in God is totally irrational. It's like believing in Father Christmas. There is no proof that God exists, no evidence, full stop. And you notice a couple of things. You notice that your friend has said this loudly enough that everybody else in the coffee shop is heard and they're all turning and listening to you. So you've got an audience now. Your heart is racing. Your palms are that little bit sweaty. What do you say? You want to say something thought-provoking and intelligent. You don't want to look like a religious idiot, but where do you begin? Well, this is where this question can be really helpful. You see, rather than try and launch into a lecture or a sermon or whatever, what if you just turned to your friend and said, well, thank you for that, but I just have a question, if I may. When you say only idiots believe in God, what do you mean by that? I mean, some pretty smart people, both in the past and today, believe in God. So just out of interest, what particularly is stupid about belief in God? You might say, hey, you said there's no evidence that God exists. What do you mean by the word evidence? What would count as evidence for you? What would you need to see or hear to maybe make you think there was a God, perhaps? And then lastly, you might say, you use the word God a couple of times. What do you mean by that? When you say God, what do you mean? I've occasionally asked atheist friends that, and being told in reply, "Well, I don't believe in the guy who lives in the sky with a great big beard and the lightning bolts." To which I like to respond, "That sounds like a very strange mix-up of Thor and Father Christmas, and that is, quite frankly, I can understand why you'd find that silly, but that's not what Christians believe in." Any of those approaches that I've outlined there, I think increase the chance you could turn this encounter into a conversation rather than it descend into an argument. And I'm a great believer if we can get conversations started, God works through those in amazing ways. So that's just a couple of examples of how you might use that particular question. Let me move on now to the next question. It's not dissimilar, actually, and it's the why do you think that question? And again, let's use a scenario. Let's imagine that this time you're at work. Let's imagine you're sitting in the staff canteen, the staff cafe at your workplace. Many of you are medics, so maybe it's in the hospital if you work in hospital. And you're sitting in the staff canteen eating your lunch, and of course reading your big black leather Bible, because every Christian in the workplace carries the biggest Bible they can find everywhere they go, right? And you're sitting in the staff canteen eating your lunch, reading the Bible, and when a colleague walks past, and seeing the Bible that's propped up there on the table alongside your sandwich, your colleague just remarks in passing, "Oh, why would you bring a Bible into work? I mean, nobody believes in the Bible these days. It's a book of ancient fairy tales and myths and legends. Oh, and it's full of contradictions." And by the way, just to make this interesting, this is not just any colleague, it's a senior colleague. Perhaps it's a senior consultant at the hospital, someone who you can't really afford to, annoy too much, or it could have implications for your career. So what do you say to what they've just said? Well, this again is where the why do you think that question can be really helpful. What if you simply said to your colleague, "Well, hey, thank you for what you've shared there. I've heard other people say similar things before, but I wonder if I might ask a question. What evidence is it that you've seen that's just led you to that conclusion that you've shared?" In other words, you're asking them why they think what they think. You're asking them to justify their skepticism. Equally, you might pick up on the particular word contradictions. You might say, "Hey, you said there are contradictions in the Bible. Could you help me out? When you've looked at the Bible, what is it that you've seen or read there that's made you you've had problems with? What are some of the contradictions you had in mind?" Now, having tried this, one of two things will happen. Either your colleague will say, "Well, everybody knows," which is shorthand for, "I've got no idea. I was on YouTube last night and I heard an atheist say it, and now I'm repeating it." And you've called out the fact they're just repeating secondhand skepticism. Or they might give you something. What if you ask about contradictions and your friend actually, your colleague actually is able to give you an example? Well, there, if you actually give you something specific, that's wonderful. You have something to work with. If you know the answer to the issue that they've raised, don't be rude. Just share it politely. Just say, "Well, I wonder if you've ever thought about," and offer the answer. If you don't know the answer, there is no need to panic or be afraid. You can simply say to your colleague, "Well, do you know what? Thank you for that. I'm a Christian who likes to be thought through. So just leave that with me, and I'll find you the answer and I'll get back to you." And then be true to your word. Read a book, do an internet search, talk to an older, wiser Christian, because that gives you a wonderful opportunity next time you see your colleague, or you can search them out and go knock on their office door. And you can say, "Well, thank you for that great question you raised the other lunchtime. I actually found the answer. Are you interested?" And if you do that in a friendly way, there's every chance then, they'll say, "Yeah, what have you got?" And a conversation has begun. And again, we're looking for conversations here. But look, what if your colleagues and friends are not throwing anti-Christian remarks around the coffee shop or the cafe? What if a lot of your friends and colleagues are like a lot of my friends, they're just not interested in spiritual things? And it can be really hard starting conversations with people who say, "I'm just not interested in religion or faith or God or so on." Well, this is where the third and final question can really help you, and it's the "Have you ever wondered" question. Let me show you how this works, not with a slightly funny example, but this time with a real story. I have a friend who is a teacher in a school in the south of England, and as a Christian teaching in a secular school, John has to be very careful what he says or doesn't say to his colleagues and to his students. But he's found if he learns to ask wandering questions, God can work in amazing ways. He told me that on one occasion he was teaching a class on ethics to his students. He teaches ethics and philosophy in this school. He was teaching a class on ethics, and he put this picture up on the PowerPoint slide. This is the cover of Time magazine from the 9th of August 2010. And it's a very famous cover. It won photojournalism awards. And it shows the beautiful but mutilated face of a young girl called Bibi Asia. Who was she? Well, at the time of this story, she was a 14-year-old Afghan teenager who was forcibly married off to a Taliban warlord in his 50s. He proceeded to horribly abuse her and mistreat her. And so she ran away, but she was captured. They cut off her nose and they cut off her ears and they threw her out to die in the mountains. Thankfully, she was rescued by United Nations aid workers and flown to the West, given reconstructive surgery, and is now living a very different life. But it's a very striking image. And so John asked his class, okay, who here thinks that what was done to Bibi Asia was wrong? John said to me, thankfully, every hand in the class went up. It is never a good day when you discover a psychopath lurking at the back of your class on a Friday afternoon. But then John asked the follow-up question. He said, okay, why is it wrong? He said, this time there was a longer period of silence. For one kid raised her hand and said, well, it's not right, Mr. Broadbanks. They violated her human rights. And John was able to say, well, that's a really good answer. But tell me, why is it wrong to violate someone's human rights? And he said, for the next 5 or 10 minutes, it was really interesting. His students would offer suggestions and John would simply say, but why? Finally, one kid in frustration kind of bangs the desk and says, but it's just wrong, sir. I can't tell you why it's wrong, but it's just wrong. And John was then able to say, do you know, have you ever wondered what is so magical about being a human being, that we get this special set of rights and values and dignity that we don't attach to other creatures? What is so special about us? And at the end of that little discussion, John was able to ask another wondering question. He was able to say to his class, have you wondered that when it comes to human rights, I wonder if we need to be very careful exactly what it is we believe? Because if you believe in some kind of God or something like that, it's very easy to make sense of human rights because you can say that God created us with value. If, on the other hand, you are an atheist and you think we are just cosmic accident, it doesn't really make sense talking about human rights. Well, not merely did that wandering question open up lots more conversations with his students, it also opened up a conversation with his head of department, who had been sitting in the back of the class observing the lesson. This man, a man who had previously called himself an agnostic, a man who would say, I don't care about faith, came almost running up to John in the staff room that afternoon and said, that was an amazing discussion you just led with the class back there. He said, do you know, it never occurred to me before that human rights is a ludicrous, a stupid idea if there is no God. Maybe more things believe stand or fall on belief in God than I'd really thought about. And that opened up this incredible conversation between John and his colleague that is still, as far as I know, going on, actually. And it all happened because John asked a wandering question. And with practice, you can learn to ask wandering questions about lots of things that your friends care about. For example, have you ever wondered why justice matters? All of our friends care about justice, but why does justice matter if we're just atoms and particles? There's a wandering question. Have you ever wondered why beauty and art move us deeply if our only purpose in life is survival and reproduction? Why does beauty or art or music move us in incredible ways? There's a really interesting conversation to start with a friend. Have you ever wondered why we get so upset about greed? You know, if we're living in a godless world, presumably the person who dies with the most stuff has won the game. But nobody thinks that Our secular colleagues don't think that, and there is a spiritual conversation starter. And by the way, if you want a biblical example of this in action, go have a look at Acts 17 sometime, where Paul is in Athens, and he uses a wandering question. Have you ever wondered about this unknown God you've built an altar to? And he does this beautiful sermon off the back of a wandering question. And in short, with a wandering question, you're looking for something your friend, your colleague already cares about. Things like justice, beauty, meaning, significance, truth, the list goes on. And you're asking your friends, your colleagues, have you ever wondered why that matters to you? Have you wondered what the source of this thing is? It's a very gentle way of starting conversations about the deepest things of life and questions that really only have an answer if God exists. And by the way, the risk of a shameless plug, we have a little book coming out at Solas next year. Do take a look at the Solas website called Have You Ever Wondered, which is full of 30 different questions, topics that you can ask wandering questions about. And if you go to that website address on the slide too, there's lots of free resources there too, designed to show you lots of different ways we can use that wandering question about different subjects to start conversations with our friends. Because I firmly believe it's by asking good questions, just like Jesus models in the Gospels, that we can start conversations and create the space for sharing answers. And in all of this, of course, the beautiful thing is that it's the gospel and only the gospel that offers the deepest questions to the things our colleagues and friends are asking about, questions about purpose and meaning and hope. Peter mentioned that event I did at that golf club the other week in his hometown. The topic that night was hope, and already showing how in today's broken world, I think Christianity offers a hope that nothing else can. We can answer those questions and show how the gospel points to the answers, those deepest questions our friends are asking. So my prayer for each of you, wherever you are around the world, is that you would, by the power of the Spirit, have the boldness to ask good questions, start great conversations, share Jesus naturally in those conversations. And as you do, point your colleagues back to Jesus, the one who said, I have come that they might have life and have it to the full. And on that note, back to Peter, and thanks to all of you for listening.
Thanks very much, Andy. We've been listening to Dr. Andy Bannister on how to talk about Jesus without looking like an idiot. And we've got some time now for Q&A. So if you do have questions, you might want to ask Andy, what do you mean by that? Or what do you think about, or why do you think that? Or you might ask him what he's ever wondered. But I'm sure you've got other questions for him as well. And so please type those into the Q&A and we'll pick those up in our discussion as we work through. Andy, the first question you raise, what do you mean by that, presupposes, doesn't it, that they've said something that you can ask that question about. And I think a lot of people listening to this will probably think, well, I'm not quite even getting to that stage where my friend or family member is saying something deep enough that I can latch onto and say, what do you mean by that? So how do we, you know, your examples, I mean, many of us will not be, we'll be sitting in a cafe perhaps, but we won't even have a very, very small Bible on the table, let alone a big black one. So, those examples, I mean, those opportunities do happen where people make a statement, but often it's the getting started right at the
beginning. Isn't it?
What do you think?
So let me share a couple of thoughts, Peter. I mean, I was being deliberately sort of comic, obviously, in the big black leather Bible, because that's what we'd like to be. I often think these questions, you know, I keep thinking about flipping them around, but actually, you know, I think that I like the wandering question where it lands. So what I would say is the first thing is you can use the wandering question to raise these kind of issues. So a good example would be, you know, I've got an old friend who also happens to be called John. Not all my friends are called John, but who for many years would call himself an agnostic. He wasn't interested in faith. I tried in sort of faulting kind of way, never got anywhere. And then at my way in, on one occasion, I noticed he had a sticker on the back of his car for Amnesty International. And I sort of did a wandering question. I said, I'm really intrigued by that. Why is that there? And he talked about how he loved, you know, that organization, the stuff they fought for. And then I just cheekily said, but why do you think justice matters? Does it really matter? After all, who cares what happens to people on the other side of the world? And, you know, cue outrage. And then that was my link into saying, look, I'm joking, John, you know me well enough. I think these things really do matter. I just gently suggest that I wonder whether Christianity has a better foundation for this than actually whatever it is you believe. Now, then I think then an objection came, and I was then able to use a what do you mean by that kind of question. So there's a number of ways of doing that. The other thing I'm also a great believer in, Peter, I joke about the Big Black Bible, but I do think, and I actually learned this from a friend who's a medic. I've got a friend who's a Georgie Costa, who's involved with the Christian Medical Fellowship in the UK. And I've got this lovely phrase from Georgie where she talks about flying a faith flag at work. Find ways to signal that you are a Christian. We often hide it away. Now, reading the Big Black Leather Bible might not be the right way, but a really good way is the what did you do on the weekend conversation. You know, a lot of Christians, I think, and I was like this, shy away from the really using church as a good example here. So if your colleague on Monday asks you, how was your weekend? Talk about the brilliant Saturday you had playing soccer and going to see a movie. Talk about the family lunch you had on the Sunday. But included in that, Peter, say, I went to church on Sunday. It was brilliant to hang out with other followers of Jesus. The pastor preached a sermon I'm still thinking about. Do you know what? Nothing may happen, but actually more things will happen if you start doing that regularly, because you've normalized the fact you're a Christian. Your colleagues are going to start clocking that you are a Christian, and those questions may come in due course. So yeah, maybe not the big black giant leather Bible, but find other ways of signaling to your friends that your faith is something you take seriously.
Yeah, sure. And a lot of our listeners will identify with that whole idea of a faith flag, because it's very much part of the Saline process training that a lot of our national groups are doing. So just giving
look at that. It's like we rehearsed that link there, you know, Peter.
Yeah, no, that's great. So you talked about one of the fears being asked difficult questions.
Yes.
And you know, we know there are a whole group of questions that come up, and without wanting to engage you on any one specific question, can you give us a few pointers about the principles of responding to difficult questions? What's a good way of approaching it? Yeah.
Well, the first thing I would say, Peter, actually, when someone raises a difficult question, you know, using a variation of the what or the why questions can be helpful. The ones I will often start with is I'll listen to the question, and I'll often try and begin by saying, well, you know, thank you for that. That's a really good question. Tell me, just out of interest, why do you ask it? Because understanding where it comes from can be helpful. Very simple example. If someone asks about suffering and how you can believe in a good God in a world of suffering, it matters, doesn't it? Are they asking that because they're just being theoretical and trying to be clever? Or are they asking that because they've just lost a loved one in a traffic accident? Or, of course, in the world of medicine, right, to go, you know, medics are on the front line. You can see life at its absolute roughest. And that raises all kinds of questions. So where are they coming from? And then cheekily, you know, a self-promotional plug in the book, I've got a chapter right where I walk people through five steps that you can approach with any question. But very briefly, they are these. Start by sympathizing. Always try and find a connection to the listener. If they're asking about suffering, talk about how you've had that question. You know, if you've experienced suffering in your own life, lean on that, build a connection. Secondly, try and identify a way where you can perhaps expose an assumption that's been brought into that question. So, for example, if someone raises the suffering question, it can be really interesting to say something like, you know, isn't it interesting how we all ask the why question when confronted with suffering? Even my secular friends don't go, oh, suffering's just nature and tooth and claw. We all protest when it's Vladimir Putin invading Ukraine, or when someone dies far too young. There's that natural why instinct. Where to ask about that? Where does that come from? Third thing, try and bring your listener into the biblical story slightly. You know, I like to look for an early opportunity to say something like, you know, one of the things I appreciate about the Bible is it's very honest about suffering and evil and injustice. It tells us that the world, something has actually gone wrong, and these things are not supposed to be there. That's why we react. Fourthly, try and make a connection to Jesus. And again, a simple way around this example I'm using, is to say that it's interesting when most of us are confronting suffering, what we want is not something said about evil, but we want something done about evil and suffering and pain. And the hope of the Christian message is that God has done something about those things in Jesus, not just said something. And then lastly, Peter, if it's a complicated question and you fumbled your way through it, that's fine. Try and find an opportunity to give somebody or point someone to a resource that goes deeper. You know, be it a podcast or a book or something. One of my friends told me the other day that she carries 5 or 6 little Christian books in her bag on the key topics she's asked. There are some wonderful resources out there. You know, if you come across good things in your language, you know, build a little resource library, if you'll call it, if you get questions that you carry in your, you know, your handbag or your laptop case or whatever, because it's really powerful if you could say to a friend, hey, I've actually got a book on that very subject. And books can be a really important ministry, actually. But these days, podcasts, YouTubes, whatever. So those 5 steps, Peter, would be what I would try and do. But be real, be honest, don't panic, ask good questions. And remember, you're trying to get a conversation going here, not a Q&A lecture sort of thing.
Sure. And as you've said already, it's beautiful, isn't it, the way we see an example of the Lord himself, how he knew all the answers, but he was asking questions in order to open people up and get them to reflect. So we've got another one here. Jo Byfleet is saying, she says, thanks for the very practical suggestion, so helpful. But how much should we be actually trying to avoid looking stupid or standing out? And is our lack of willingness to do this actually part of the problem? It's coming back to this whole idea of the spiritual battle, isn't it?
Yeah. Brilliant. Thank you for that. That was a Joe. That is a brilliant question. And I always hope somebody asks it, because the book title is slightly provocative, because we are called in the scriptures to be fools for Christ. But I do think there's a difference between being a fool and being an idiot. An idiot is someone who makes such a mess of things that actually you do more harm than good. And none of us want to end up there. That's the fear. But there's also the willingness to lose reputation, to not fit into the crowd, to have people scoff and such like. I mentioned Acts 17 earlier, where Paul uses wandering questions in Athens. We read at the end that some people sneered. Some believed, but some sneered. So we need to be willing to take that. One other thought here too as well, Joe, is that I began to realize years ago that if we're afraid of something around our faith, that fear, I think, can reveal where our idols are. So if we're afraid of losing reputation, could it just be that reputation has become more important to us than the gospel? So actually, if you are afraid of evangelism, I don't want you to feel guilty at all. That's not my job to guilt trip you. But I would encourage you to take that before the Lord, maybe talk it through with an older, wiser Christian, and go, I just need some prayer in this area, because I just wonder whether, you know, I've allowed my love of an easy life to overcome. Actually, it is going to be hard when we share our faith. And I talk a lot about that in the book, actually, that nothing we're going to do is going to make evangelism so simple we could do it standing on our heads with no risk, because there's always a risk. I think what we can do with practice, learning from Jesus, learning from others, learning some practical tools, we can take away some of the unnecessary things that make it harder. But you're still ultimately going to come down to the heart's always going to beat fast and the palms get sweaty. We share our faith, and it should do, because we're talking about very, very serious things.
Absolutely. We've got quite a wide cultural, different set of cultural context today, as you can imagine.
Yes.
And so here's a question from Yusuf in Sudan, and he's asking the question, in your journey, you've had a lot of encounters with Muslims. Of course, you've done your PhD in this whole area.
Yes.
What advice would you give to those of us who meet Muslims almost on a daily basis? And perhaps particularly, what kind of questions have you found helpful in terms of opening up conversations with Muslims?
Yeah. Thank you for that, that Yusuf. And yes, I mean, I've been engaging with Muslims for sort of 25 years now, and love engaging with Muslims, actually, because with a Muslim, it's not often hard to start a conversation about faith, right? Whereas with our secular friends, it can be. So a couple of thoughts, Yusuf. Straight away, if I've got a colleague or a friend or a neighbor, someone I meet who's a Muslim, I will often take the opportunity to begin by asking about their faith. So I'll say, hey, am I right? You're a Muslim? And they'll usually say yes. I'll say, oh, that's really interesting. What do you believe? I used to say, I don't know much about Islam. What do you believe? I sort of find that I have to sort of cross my fingers slightly because I know quite a lot about Islam. But if you don't know anything, all the better, because you can say, I know nothing about Islam. What do you believe? And I would suggest, for the, where possible, spend the first 15, 20 minutes, if it's a longer conversation, asking lots about what they believe. Ask follow-up questions. Just follow naturally where the conversation leads. Because then what you're looking for after, 10, 15 minutes, Yusuf, I'm looking for a chance to then pivot and say to them, this is really interesting. This is really interesting. Look, I'm a Christian, and some of the things you talk about, we have in common. But there are also things that are quite different. There's some quite big differences. Now, hopefully your friend will say, such as, and which is great, and then you can talk about them. If they don't, quite frankly, you can say, for example, and then you can talk about some of those. And then what you obviously want to do is talk about the uniquenesses of the Christian faith. In particular, I always want to start from God, actually. Sometimes we as Christians, we leap too quickly to Jesus and the Trinity and those things. To me, the key issue is that in Islam, you have a God who is remote and distant, and not involved directly with us. Whereas in the Bible, you have a God who's relational, a God who can be known, a God who is love, and a God who has suffered in and through Jesus. And I want to lean into those points. So that's the first thing. Other thing you can do is you can ask specific questions. So questions about God are a good one, for example. So to say to your Muslim friend, if they mention God, say, hey, just out of interest, when you say God, what do you mean by that? Tell me what you understand by God. You can say things like, one of the things I appreciate about Muslims, you are people who respect Jesus. But I'm just intrigued. What do you believe about Jesus? What do you understand about Jesus? And again, lead with the questions before you then transition over to what you believe. And one last thought, actually, with Muslims, Yusuf, to me, where you're heading for far more so than with secular friends. With secular friends, you want to get to the Bible, but it may take a bit longer. With Muslim friends, I'm always looking for an opportunity to dig the Bible open and say something like, hey, this conversation reminds me of the story that Jesus told. And then use your example of whatever story of Jesus told. And chances are your Muslim friends never encountered it. And it's a great opportunity to go, hey, can we actually look at something Jesus said or something Jesus did? And often, if you do this friendly and a respectful way, Muslims are quite open, are open to that. And a related way of doing it, by the way, is to suggest to your Muslim friend, why don't you meet for coffee next week and do a Quran and Bible study there? That's quite an interesting evangelism idea. You get them to bring their favorite Quran verse, you bring your favorite Bible verse, and you talk about them. And trust me, when you do that, there'll be far more time ends up being covered on the Bible than on the Quran. It always happens. So just a few ideas there. A lot more on the Solas website, by the way. If you go to the Solas website, I put a link in the chat and type Islam into our search engine. Lots of free resources there to help you go a little bit deeper.
Thank you so much. We've got a question from Mark Pickering here. You may well know Mark, who's the
Oh, the
CEO of
notorious, sorry, the famous
CMF.
Mark Pickering.
That's right, CMF UK. And we had Jay Smith on a few times on webinars a little while ago, and he was talking about the hermeneutical key, the fact that relationship is the difference really
Yes.
between Islam and Christianity. But he went on to give talks on three of the areas of new research. Around Muhammad, around the Quran, around Mecca as well,
Yeah.
showing the shakiness of the foundations there. And Mark's specific question is, do you find that this area of new Islamic historical material is one that works well with a questioning approach?
Well, yeah, thanks for that, Mark. And Mark and I cut our teeth at Speaker's Corner with Jay up a ladder at Hyde Park in London, street preaching kind of years ago. I love that whole kind of historical critical approach that that Jay and myself and others have done lots of stuff in. The one weakness to it is you need a lot of information. You really need to learn and master stuff. I remember at Speaker's Corner, feeling for the first 6 months I was doing nothing but reading so I could master this stuff. And that for many of us is a bit much. And then the other problem is if you're talking to a Muslim who is an academic in their faith, you can simply get the pushback very easily. Well, I don't understand these things. So I think it's great material for those of us who are wired that way and to be aware of. But often for ordinary Muslims, it's a bit like water off a duck's back. There's a nice metaphor for the translators to figure out the dynamic equivalent of. What I would say, Mark, though, is with any of this material, yes, you can turn it into a question. You know, are you aware of, you know, have you come across the, you know, this idea that some scholars have discovered that, you know, the evidence for Mecca being the starting place of Islam looks quite questionable, and then see how your Muslim friend responds. Let me give an example, by the way, of how you can use a question versus a statement on something simpler. So I remember when I first began engaging with Muslims very early on, as I was reading the Quran, I came across the 9th chapter, verse 5 of the Quran. That's one of the most bloodthirsty verses in the Quran that talks about, you know, sort of attacking and slaying unbelievers. And I tried that out with Muslim friends early on. I would say, oh, the Quran's bloodthirsty and Muhammad's character, look at this verse. And the barriers would go up. And actually, often we ended up getting stuck. But then I discovered, if I said to my Muslim friend, I was reading the Quran last night because I knew we were meeting today, and I came across this verse. I was leafing through the Quran. I came across chapter 9, verse 5, and I read this verse, and wow, I found this quite difficult. But then I realized this is not my scripture. This is your scripture. And so what do you think when you read this passage? How do you handle it? That was massively more effective and more damaging and went deeper. Because if they sort of raised an issue and said, are you saying, oh, no, I'm not saying at all, I'm asking. And I think trying to find the way of turning, you know, things into a question can be very, very helpful. But Mark, your basic idea, yes, the Quran, you know, Islam stands on two pillars, stands on Muhammad and it stands on the Quran. And if either of those fall, the whole thing is in trouble. But let's also remember that we must be careful that we don't, you know, try and demolish Islam without also building a bridge to an alternative. Because I have seen people walk away from Islam, sadly, into atheism rather than into following Jesus. So all that great material that Jay and others have pioneered, use it well if that's the kind of thing that excites you. But yeah, let's make sure we're also introducing our Muslim friends to Jesus as well.
And just one more question again from an Islamic context, because we're pretty much out of time now. Mm-hmm. We could go on with this for some time, but we've got someone asking here from a Muslim majority country, happens to be Indonesia this time.
Okay, yeah.
And this person says, I'm eager to start small simply by sharing my own personal experience. Excellent. And relationship with Jesus. So the whole thing about testimony. And the question is, how do you suggest transitioning from asking clinical questions, or perhaps more apologetic questions, to patients, to sharing personal experiences, or perhaps asking them about their personal experiences?
Yeah. Well, I think one way of doing that is, as you say, is you could start with those kind of clinical questions, because that's what you're there to do. And I think it's important as Christians in the workplace, we don't subvert that, because we want to be employees who you know, work hard, and that our employers and colleagues look at us and go, I'm glad they're on my team. I gave you that example of my friend Peter in Toronto, who'd figured out the way to do it was through those kind of life questions. Do the sort of slightly broader questions from, okay, you come here with a headache, but let's also talk about your health more generally, because that allows the spiritual question in. And I think what then happens, if they, you know, if they respond to that, if they don't respond, you have to respect it. If they respond, you know, then there's a natural opportunity to say something like, you know, if they pick up on prayer, for example, to go, well, one thing I find about prayer when I'm struggling, when life really is bearing down on me, I actually found prayer to be incredibly helpful. Have you found anything like that? If you're talking to a Muslim, you can get into talking about prayer quite easily. And actually, I found with Muslim sort of friends sometimes, you know, very quickly, you've got natural opportunities to offer to pray. So, yeah, so that's the kind of pathway I would walk through. Start with the clinical, let's say they're there to do. Look for those kind of life questions that let you link to the the spirituality piece. And one last thought on that as well, and I know depending on the setting you're in, this may or may not be appropriate, but I've also found over the years that the more time that we invest in really getting to know people and their background and their story and their family. So I've got another friend who's a doctor, a good friend of mine who's a family doctor in this country. And you know, one of the things that he's modeled, he works in a smaller town and community where he's known, or he walks around the town. So just taking that interest in patients, getting, making sure you know their name, their backstory, their husband's name, their kids' names, because he said, I found the more that I take that concern, the more they ask about me. And then it's actually very, how's your family doctor? And then it's very easy to go, oh, they're great. My kids are just, doing well at youth group at church or whatever. And he's in. So taking that interest in people. Now, as I say, if you're the kind of doctor who sort of just, you're seeing people more on a sort of, irregular basis, that's harder. But we can do that with our colleagues too, I think. Just be people who ask questions. And as you read the Gospels, as I say, Jesus asked 300 questions in the Gospels. Really good discipline. When you come across a question, think on, pray on, reflect on, could I use that question in my everyday life? And then again, you're learning and applying questions from the Master.
Yeah, brilliant. And that's a great note to end on, I think, as well. So thank you so much, Dr. Andy Bannister, for speaking to us today and enlightening us on this subject of how to talk about Jesus without looking like an idiot. And of course, thanks to all of you for coming along and joining us on ICMDA webinars. May the Lord bless you, and we look forward to seeing you again soon. Thank you.